Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV.
Hey, folks, Roland Martin here. Today on News One Now, our Black Book Fest 2015. And you guys know I love books. I got my hashtag, Roland's Book Club. And we're taking a look at the best books of the year with interviews that I did right here on News One Now on TV One. Books by celebrities like rap pioneer Luther Campbell, Charlie Wilson, producer Issa Rae. We also delve into politics with Joy Ann Reid and former Virginia Governor Doug Wilder. Plus, personal stories from actor Wendell Pierce and Miss Jessie's co-founder Miko Branch. We also have books with different takes on Black history, such as The Legacy of Black Female Singers, Passing for White, and also Slavery. Get healthy with Dr. Eon Smith's Super Shred Diet Cookbook. Also, hear from a couple of women who came for infertility with healthy living. Plus, we'll end with a little inspiration with Bishop T.D. Jakes and a woman who speaks with angels. We've got all of that more coming up right now on our News One Now Black Book Fest 2015. Had to navigate this whole issue. You were working on, I think, a project with Shonda Rhimes and ABC that didn't come to fruition. You just signed the deal with HBO to work on a pilot. I mean, it is an arduous process.
Completely. And it just, it's a system. It's a formula at the end of the day. And I think going through the ABC process, that's what really made me realize, like, this is nuts. This is inefficient. And it actually kills creativity in a way. And I want to create a system where the writer is king, you know, like television is supposed to be, in a sense.
You've been standing in for Beyonce, Halle Berry. Who are some of the other folks that you have done some work with?
Well, I've worked with Vivica A. Fox on Kill Bill, Halle Berry on Extant, Vanessa Williams on Desperate Housewives, Shaft, which is one of my favorites, Rihanna on Battleship, Natalie Emmanuel on Fast and Furious 7. Those are just a few of the girls I've doubled.
So first of all, I mean, obviously this is very physical. So what kind of training do you go through?
Oh, I do a lot of different things. I've been training martial arts since I was a young girl. I swim, I do yoga, I do martial art weapons, I train in firearms, I train with, you know, all different kinds of cars. I go to driving school constantly, and you're always working on doing 90s and 180s and hitting a mark and 360s.
You were talking about this world that a lot of people go, wait a minute, what is this world about? You wrote, the problem was Marvin did participate. He watched. He egged me on. He closely observed the three of us engage in a long sexual dance, yet he himself stood to the side. I don't know whether it was the coke or the jealousy, but Marvin claimed that he couldn't perform. Then you said, after this, he said, I'll never be able to satisfy you again. From now on, you'll require this sort of extravagant stimulation. One man will never be enough for you. I saw you, and now I'll never be able to trust you. As a woman, as a wife, how were you going through that, saying, but wait a minute, I'm doing this for you, now you're not trusting me. How did that impact the relationship?
Well, you had to know Marvin to really understand the way that I learned to understand. Mm-hmm. A lot of what he would say was, a lot of it was for effect, a lot of it was rhetoric, and I had to learn to know the difference. And people seemed to think that this was an everyday occurrence, that we were doing threesomes, that we were doing all kinds of crazy things 24/7, and that was just not the case. I would have to do a lot more writing if I were to tell the world everything that went on within our marriage.
It just was time to tell people the history of Southern hip hop and how it was formed and some of the significant things that I did, you know, to actually save hip hop from going to the Supreme Court, you know, fighting different obscenity trials that would have directly affected the music business. And it's just so many different things that people just don't know.
One of the things that I found to be amazing is the fact that you understood money. You understood how to make money. One of the stories I love in the book where these rappers were sitting there saying, man, what you doing? And you're like, I'm counting the money from merchandise. They cut deals where they gave somebody else. They took a small check and got a cut where you were sitting here going, no, I'm counting 30 grand we made tonight.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I talk about that story in the book, you know, where I talk to, you know, guys like, you know, Will Smith and Kubo D and all us. We would be doing shows around the country and, you know, guys start, you know, at the beginning, you know, we wasn't accepted, you know, but then along the way, when people start asking questions about, you know, how are you doing this? You know, and I said, well, I'm manufacturing my own records, and I normally buy them for 30 cents, and I'm selling them for, you know, $1.27, and that's basically the same thing that you're doing, but you're not making as much money. And the same thing goes for merchandise. You know, guys were doing deals with companies like Winterland and getting $1,500, and I was going to the same venue making $30,000 and $40,000 a night.
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting, and I read a book by Jerry Weintraub that I actually called Jerry, and Jerry died just a couple of months ago, and I said this book should be required reading in business classes, business courses. And I will say the same thing about your book, because you detail, you know, not knowing how the game worked, but literally understanding this distributor, West Coast, East Coast, Midwest, going to these various folks. It's not like you had a banker sitting next to you. You literally had to walk through it yourself, how to do the deal. And at one point, you were the only black-owned or the largest black-owned independent label in America.
Yes, you know, and it was unfortunate because, again, you know, Southern hip hop, there was no Southern hip hop. I basically started Southern hip hop down here in Miami, and no other company from whether it was California or New York wanted to hear anything about a hip hop company or a group from Miami. So I had to use the common sense approach, you know, by just, you know, using common sense, putting the records in the trunk of my car, you know, going from one level to the next and you know, talking to distributors, you know, hey, how did I get a record in the store after I sold records to the flea markets? And I just used the common sense approach. And just like you say, I think, you know, a lot of people would be happy by reading this book to just understand a young guy pulling himself up from the bootstraps and the creation of Southern hip hop.
Look, it was interesting. A lot of folks, when they were tweeting me as I was reading the book, they were talking about, how he destroyed music and sex and things along those lines. And I want to talk about that. But one of the things I did find to be interesting, it didn't dawn on me really until I spent time in various Caribbean nations. Being there in Miami, there's the infusion of Caribbean music, soca, salsa, which is dance music, party music, but also very sexual. You mean you look? I was in St. Kitts where they had Carnival, and I was like, whoa! And so as I was sitting reading your book, thinking of that, basically your deal was, you just combine all of that to create really what you were doing.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what it was. You know, we could have went and tried to rap and sound and break dance like the guys in New York or Philadelphia, but that's not where we're from. You know, I'm from Miami, you know, and the music is from Miami, and we have a lot of Latin influence. We have a Haitian influence. We have Jamaicans, Bahamians. This is a Caribbean island. I mean, you go to any party, if you go to a Jamaican party right now, you'll see, you know, the dances, whether they're winding up on a man, you think you're looking at a lap dance, but it's not. It's a traditional dance that have been done, you know, way before Luther Campbell's time. And we just tried to do music and the look of the album covers based on where we're from. You know, I know people, you know, in Idaho don't get how can girls be standing up on a beach in bikinis in a music video looking like bikinis, but this is where we're from, and we want to just represent our city.
It's the darkest time of my life, Roland, to be able to go and rehash all that I went through, and I had to put that in this book. And some things I took out. You know, I didn't, you know, I'd say I just shouldn't, I don't want to say this, but it was really hard. It's like I had to relive a crackhead's life. As simple as that. And I was so wrapped up into this dark time in trying to write this book. I had to go in a room and go in the shower and just lay in there for like 30 minutes and just let water run over me. And I remember Deneen saying, "You're getting a little hostile." I was like, "You weren't taking me back there. I don't want to go back there." She said, "You should calm down a little bit." I was like, "Calm down. I'm already upset."
Deneen Miller.
Right. You sound like you're getting a little testy there. You bringing all these things up. I was like, I don't want to, you making me talk about these things, these feelings. But very emotional. But, you know, I had to tell this, you know what I'm saying? Because I needed, again, to empty the garbage can.
When you, and you talk about in the book, when you were coming back, mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of people didn't want anything to do with you.
Yeah, most of those executives, I mean, they could have helped me out. They really could have helped me out. But they were the ones, even in the beginning, that turned their back on me and was telling everybody that I was washed up. And I, you know, without giving anything away in my book, I mean, I circled for 10 years looking for, they told me I was too old. And for 10 years, I was still looking for a deal. And each year as we went by, those executives were disappearing and they was without a job. And so I run into these people all the time. Now I'm selling out.
Oh, arena. Now they love you. Now they trying to hug you, kiss you.
They're telling me that I told you you was going to be big.
And you like,
I'm looking at these people and they don't know that I know that they're the ones that said they didn't want to have anything to do with me.
And you sitting there saying, if I ain't love Jesus, I'd be cussing you out right now.
I would cuss you out right now. I'm not that kind of a person. Hey, you know what? I say, hey, man, you know, I know, read the book, homie. Just read this book. Or you can come to the show. I sold out this arena, you know, at 14,000 seats when you told me I wasn't going to ever get past the theater.
As you say, your concert, you old school and new school.
That's right. I'm both of them.
Are you still surprised when you see the reaction from your fans? And have you just been stunned how they've received the book?
I am honored, and I am so happy and so fulfilled with joy and to receiving all of this love from fans with the book, the way they come to the shows, and the way they buy my CDs and records, and how the younger generation keeps asking me to come and sing with them, whether it's from America or whether it's outside the country, how so many people, reason why I'm kind of tired now is because I've been all over the world and just trying to do
just
all
got out
this.
Tour with Kim and Joe. Y'all yes. Yeah.
Yeah, those are my co-stars, and we did 40, I want to say 48, but I think it might have been 46 cities sold out.
Yeah, added a bunch of cities.
Yes,
yeah.
And we did the first leg, then the second leg, and I had the highest grossing tour in 2015, straight out, the highest grossing tour.
Well, man, you've been killing
arenas.
It. Yeah, right, arenas, not little clubs. Arenas.
Arenas, baby.
You've been killing it, folks. The book is called I Am Charlie Wilson.
Yes.
And also, let me tell y'all something. Some of y'all think Uncle Charlie is too busy to watch news. That is not the case. I can tell y'all it has actually happened. I was on TV, and Uncle Charlie said, "Man, that was a great point you made. But the tie you had on.
That watermelon one."
See? He was like, "I need to know where you got that watermelon
See,
tie.
That's the reason why I brought this watermelon color tie."
Oh, so you just match up with the tie.
To remind you of the watermelon tie that you had on.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. You know what? I think I have two of those.
Yeah.
So I got to go in my Ascot tie closet.
Oh, you got them.
And find it.
You're the one, the well-dressed anchorman in this business.
Well, you know.
Player.
You know, I don't know if anybody else bold enough to wear some linen on TV.
Yeah.
But we will do it. Yeah. Man, always a pleasure. Good luck with the book. All good seeing you. Thanks for the love.
I am Charlie Wilson.
First step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Democratic Party just love black people, but the reality is it still has to come to terms with the reality of race. Joanne Reed breaks down the party's historical racial friction in her new book, Fracture, Barack Obama and the Clintons, the Racial Divide. Here is our chat.
There was a real break between the Clintons and the Obama campaign because I think on the Clinton side, they felt that they were unfairly maligned and mischaracterized in the things that they were saying about really about the 60s, about 1964, about Lyndon Johnson, about MLK. And the Clintons really had, in 2008, for the very first time, they confronted what it was like to be opposed to the main body of black folk. They just were not used to being in that situation,
right?
Especially Bill Clinton.
I mean, I remember when he, during the campaign, when he went to a black church in Los Angeles, it didn't go over too well, even though he was with a couple of black members of Congress. It was kind of like, yeah. And he wasn't used to that in black churches.
Well, not used to it in his entire political life. I mean, you have to remember, this was a Southern governor who was used to balancing the interests of rural white voters and African-American voters and being able to do both pretty seamlessly. You know, Bill Clinton could go into a black church and get on the pulpit. That was what he was used to. He was called the first black president by one of the seminal authors in the black world, Toni Morrison, because he had this affect and this comfort level with African-Americans. But all of a sudden in 2008, particularly after Barack Obama won Iowa, then Senator Obama won Iowa, African-Americans said, wait a second, we don't owe the Clintons our loyalty. We don't owe the establishment of the Democratic Party our support. We can have a real first black president, and that's what we're going to do. And I think it startled the Clintons, just as Barack Obama running for president startled the
Clintons.
What
was interesting about that, though, I know it exists today, you also had on the Obama side this sort of view of black allegiance. There were people who literally had 20 and 30 year relationships with the Clintons, and you know, my position was, you don't just throw away your relationships just because you have potentially the first black president. And so in the Obama camp, and in many cases, then Senator Obama himself had some problems with certain African Americans. Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, they had some issues.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that I find interesting, and one of the reasons I wanted to write the book and start it really in the 60s rather than with the 2008 campaign, is because throughout the history of black politics, there has been a black establishment and that has been very pragmatic.
A lot of people don't remember. You ran for president, I never forget. You ran for president in 1992. And there were African Americans who felt that you were too conservative, and they shut that down before you even got out of the gate.
He's absolutely right. And you and I had some brief talk about it. And Jesse is a friend and a fraternity brother. But I think it was more a personality thing, because the Congressional Black Caucus was taking place here. And people were coming out of the elevators asking me to come on, we need to chat. They were having fundraisers all over town. And Jesse said, well, you know, and he had said to several people, you know, I'm still around. And I said to him, I said, Jesse, let's talk and we can try to get together. The people of Virginia didn't want me to run for president because they said, Virginia's a one-term governorship. Constitutionally very strong. I had been left broke. I didn't know how broke I was as governor. And so I had to spend most of my time, I thought I could campaign on the weekends. You can't do that. And so I ran from September to December and said, hey, I'm finished, and left. The loudest applause I ever got in the joint session of the General Assembly was when I said, I am no longer a candidate for the presidency of the United States. He said, yeah. They were right. I should not have run at the time because I needed to concentrate all of my efforts in Virginia. I've never held that against Jesse. I know him well. And he's one of the better promoters that you will find. But I do recall what you said, and I thank you for it. Roland, I would have lost a ton of money had you told me that the president would have had an opportunity to appoint someone to the U.S. Supreme Court of color when the Democrats were in control of the House as well as in the Senate. So it shouldn't have been any difficulty getting that person confirmed. And I'd have lost a lot of money. If you had told me that he would have had two chances, to do that, I would have lost all of my money. Because I could not have believed that a person of color could not have understood that the Supreme Court has been that bastion of support for those people who have been denied the liberties. And I was concerned when I see Loretta Lynch being considered as Attorney General for maybe a couple of years. If she was good enough for that or this, then should she not have been considered? Thurgood Marshall's presence on the court was not just a vote. He worked to educate the other members of the court as to why they should be doing certain things, and they didn't, and that hasn't happened. So
you also were tough in saying, why was this administration afraid to really publicly embrace black issues?
Well, I would not have been able to have stayed in the room at the Congressional Black Caucus when he told those people to shut up and quit whining and put on their marching shoes. I would have used the language you would have used when that guy didn't vote for me.
And I'll be perfectly honest with you. I was right there, and I was sitting at Congressman Clyburn's table and literally lined up with the podium, and I sat there and said, I cannot believe what I just heard.
Well, you would have heard differently from me, because I was not raised that way to accept it from anyone. Who in the hell do you think you're talking to, I would have said. I don't know how loudly. I don't know if I'd have said it as loudly as Joe Wilson there when he jumped up and screamed in the Congress. But it's insulting to say that those people who have stretched out so far for you, if any white president had said that, what would they have said to him?
Yeah,
speak up here to me.
People would have walked out of the room.
Probably. Exactly.
What is the one thing that jumped out, that shocked you the most, that surprised you during the research for this book?
Nothing is terribly surprising about Michelle Obama because she talks about herself. She reveals a lot about herself. But going deep, it was fascinating to find out about her history, how she came up on the South Side of Chicago, what she learned along the way, and how that is connected directly to what she's doing now in the White House.
It's interesting when, I love it when I hear people, they talk about, oh, Michelle Obama, she went to Ivy League schools, things along those lines. I've met a lot of political wives, I've met a lot of politicians. She probably is the most real, the most down-to-earth person who gets it.
She talks, all of her friends talk about how authentic she is. She entered this political world a little reluctantly, as we all know, and she said, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to be true to myself. Mm-hmm. And when you look at who she was on the campaign trail, if you look at who she is in the White House, in this pretty darn undefined, kind of difficult role, she has figured out what she cares about and how to do something about it.
Now, when I interviewed the president, he got a little ticked off of me when I said this here. I can tell he was a little ticked about it. And I said it. I didn't care. I said, she's a better speech. She gives a better speech than you do.
Well, that's true.
No, and I will say this here. In terms of political instincts, in terms of working rope lines, in terms with people, in terms of all of that, she blows him away.
She has a personal connection with audiences, and she prepares. It's important to keep in mind.
Oh, she's giving his West Wing staff hell for her preparation.
You can hand him a speech and he'll give it. Michelle Obama wants to know the words. She wants to have those words be true to who she is. And think about all those hugs she gives out there. She is saying, I am the First Lady. I believe in you. Come, let's do a hug.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
In your book, I mean, you tell this heart-wrenching story. Again, of how you were personally impacted by Katrina. Here we are 10 years later, and it is still stunning, I think, for a lot of people. This happened in an American city.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I would not wish on my worst enemy. It's one of the moments in my life which is defining, would always be, pre-Katrina and post-Katrina, to see an American city abandoned in its darkest hour by the government that had just prepared for this 3 months prior. Most people don't know that they did a disaster drill in New Orleans 3 months prior to the storm, and the variable of what the federal government was supposed to do was abandoned and neglected, which is, they say, keep all the vehicles aside. We will come in and get everyone. The other poetic truth is the fact that New Orleanians who had evacuated, like myself, tried to get back into the city, and we were stopped. We were doing our own Dunkirk run to go, and we heard we had citizens there who were abandoned at the convention center, and we wanted to go back and help them. And like the famous Dunkirk run in Europe, and when the English Channel was flooded with private vessels, as they say, the British Army, we tried to do the same thing and were turned back. So it's a horrible and horrific memory. And I know that 20 years from now, someone's going to ask me, what did you do in the darkest hour? And as an actor, I responded with my craft, and that was the catalyst of the Wind in the Reeds.
You're building this business, things was growing, then your life and the life of Mr. Jesse changes on December 4th.
Yeah. So the loss of my sister Titi Branch has been tremendous. Not only was Titi a pioneer in the natural hair movement, not only did Titi help to restore esteem for millions of women, you know, in this country and beyond, Titi was also my sister. Titi was also an aunt. Titi was also a daughter. Titi was also, you know, part of a family who loved her very much. So, you know, the loss of Titi Branch is tremendous. The good news is that Titi and I have created so many things together, one of which is our business, Miss Jessie. So every day her spirit is with us, and we're able to just carry out a lot of the principles that she and I set forth together. So this book couldn't have come at a wonderful time when I'm talking about Titi and sharing how great she was. And it's a wonderful way for me to keep her legacy going on.
On the morning of August 31st, 1984, three men broke into a South Central Los Angeles home and murdered former NFL star Kermit Alexander's mother, sister, and two nephews. Initially, family, friends, and colleagues thought Alexander did it, a suspicion that would greatly alter his life. The allegations against Alexander were found not to be true, but he later learned that he had known one of the individuals involved in this horrendous crime. He chronicles all of this in his new book, The Valley of the Shadow of Death, a tale of tragedy and redemption. Also, a documentary being produced by former team, by his former team, the San Francisco 49ers. Here's a piece of that documentary.
As the investigation continued, we found out it was a mistaken identity, but a hired killing. And the killers, who it turned out were illiterate, went to the wrong house, read the address incorrectly, and they ended up at my mother's house, murdering her, my sister, and my two nephews. Initially, we thought that the whole family was somebody that was targeted, and so we didn't have any idea whether or not we should just hold up and pray, because we were scared to death that we were next on the list.
And Kermit joins us right now. Glad to have you here. I mean, this is a stunning story. What was it like for you going through this and folks thinking you killed your family?
It was horrendous. Because of my activities, my family and friends all thought I might have had something to do with it. Somebody I'd angered wanted revenge. And so as a consequence, they blamed me. And so for a guy that grew up in a family that was very, very close, with lots of friends, I was suddenly bereft of all of that. I had nothing, just myself, and depression. Because I didn't know if I had not done something to cause this to happen.
So someone hired these folks to kill someone.
That's correct.
And these guys went to the wrong house.
Yes. Apparently what happened was they hired them to go murder a family to eliminate a lawsuit. And because the guys were illiterate, they misread the address.
Your team had your back during this period.
That's correct.
What was that like? Having another family to lean on?
Well, it was the reason I'm probably still alive, because depression can kill you. To have someone say, we believe you, we understand something happened, and we hope that you can find out and hope it doesn't come to the rest of the family, was a major deal. Because at that point, all I had was my religion, and I wasn't so sure about that, because I was doubting everything.
Mm-hmm.
what type of relationship or situation was it with the DA? Because in too many instances we know, they lock on to a theory and then they don't want to get confused with the facts. They want to prove their theory. So talk about the relationship or the issues that you had to deal with as it related to getting those prosecutors to change and those detectives to change their approach.
Well, they were kind of in a crossfire because I was a former probation officer, so I was part of their system. And so they had to be careful to make sure that I was either guilty or innocent before they did anything. And they took the cautious approach. And I was grateful for that because I already had enough to worry about. I didn't need my superiors or former superiors to be kicking me down the curb.
First step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
And that's in Emily. You have lost your mind if you are talking about Bessie Smith, Mahalia Jackson, Billie Holiday, Aretha Franklin, Nina Simone, Etta James, and Billie Holiday, and you decide to throw Beyonce up in there. Explain that.
Beyonce herself, you know, she has done a lot of work to position herself as a kind of inheritor of and somebody who is extending this very rich, complex, multifaceted tradition of African-American women singers. So she's putting herself in line with people like Bessie Smith, Tina Turner, Aretha Franklin, and so on. And so I think respecting that and honoring that, you know, again, thinking about Beyonce not only as a cultural icon, as somebody who is interesting, you know, because she's married to Jay-Z and because, you know, she's beautiful and amazing, but also somebody who is important because of her artistry, of her vocal melismas, for example, you know, the really inventive and unique and original ways that she is able to stretch a melody and a harmony through her own vocal improvisations. Or again, the ways that she's thinking about this longer tradition and how can she kind of put herself in there and use some of it, take what is useful to her, and then kind of keep things moving and keep things fresh and innovative.
That was very common. It was very, very common that people had to separate from their families. If they decided to pass, that if someone were to die, that they would not let the family know that this person had died. Often people would find out, just as in your case, a month or more later. Sometimes they wouldn't find out until they read an obituary in a newspaper. And that was exactly the case, that they were terrified that black relatives would show up at the funeral and would destroy this image of whiteness that the family had so carefully protected. There's a really famous story of a woman named Elsie Roxborough, who was from Detroit, and she passed as white. She ended up committing suicide in New York City. And her sister, who also looked white, traveled to claim her body because, again, they wanted her to be able to still be white even in death.
Walter yes. White, of course, was one of the leaders of the NAACP.
Right.
No, folks, it's and so it's interesting about him
yes.
because he actually, when he would travel south,
right,
he would actually pass for white, and he used that to gain information for the NAACP.
Absolutely. He would investigate lynching, so he was very interested in exposing the crime of lynching. So he would travel to the South, he would sort of get to know the people who were involved in the lynching, and then he would travel back to the North and write articles and discuss this rampant crime. And there's a great story about Walter White where he's sitting on a train and a white man sits down next to him and he says, you know, I can identify these black people who pass as white. I know how to identify them. And he takes Walter White's hand into his and he says, see, if you were black, I'll use the polite word. Obviously, this man did not call him black, but mm-hmm. he said, if you were black, I'd be able to tell by the half moons on your fingernails.
It is not just a story about the slave plantations of the American South and the planters in the American South profiting from the institution of slavery, but it's very much also the merchants and bankers of New York City, of Boston, of Providence, who are very much involved in that slave economy. What they basically do is they connect the slave economy of the American South to the booming industrial economy of Europe and New England. So
what you're saying is, Ben, without slavery, without the cotton, then you don't have the economic resources to finance building, finance construction, finance other industries.
Right. I mean, I think the history of the American economy is obviously not just about cotton and not just about slavery, but at the particular point in time, in the first half of the 19th century, it is absolutely at the core of the American economy.
It's the foundation. It's the base.
Yeah, and then weirdly enough, we have often told our stories about the economic ascendancy of the United States as a story of yeoman farmers in the New England countryside and of industrious artisans in seaboard cities. But what we have often ignored is the not just the contribution, but the absolute centrality of the slave economy of the American South to the national economy,
then
in turn also to the global economy. And it is in a way a kind of weird thing that we have convinced ourselves of a story of capitalism that whitewashes that story and that eliminates the history of slavery out of the history of capitalism. And Empire of Cotton, in a way, tries to bring that story back into the history of capitalism and into the history of the United States.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
We just got the cookbook, the Shred Diet Cookbook, which just came out. It's got over 190 recipes, all regular food, by the way.
Right, and that's the key, because typically whenever you hear diet, I mean, it's all kind of strength. You can't eat this, you can't eat that, and that just drives folks crazy. And so one of the reasons, I mean, I like Super Shred because I can actually eat real food.
Well, the key is that I want to show people that just because it says healthy doesn't mean it can't be tasty. So the subtitle of the Shred Diet Cookbook is Huge Flavor, Half the Calories, because we do tricks to take away some of the calories, but we keep the flavor. And by the way, there's steak in there. My barbecue steak is in there. There's
salmon burgers. I see cheese pack chicken breasts.
Yeah, I mean, it's regular food, 30 minutes or less. You don't have to go to a gourmet store to buy all these ingredients, because people want to be able to cook with regular food.
All right, so what you got here?
Okay, so there are five things you should have in your kitchen. The first thing is a blender.
Right.
Okay, start every day with a smoothie. You can get about 3 servings of fruits and vegetables in a smoothie right from the beginning of the day. You did two smoothies during your cleanse.
And so
right?
when you're talking about, right, we did the cleanse, this smoothie. So when you talk about cleanses, we're talking about what? We're talking about berries, strawberries,
kale.
And
we got some
so raw, not the frozen.
Well, no, actually.
Oh, can you do frozen?
You can do frozen. And in fact, I do frozen. I do frozen organic. And the beauty of frozen is that it makes the smoothie creamier. So you can do frozen, but you want to make sure it's organic frozen. Okay, it's how they freeze it that makes a difference.
Right.
Kale is very important, by the way. You can put kale in smoothies. You can cook kale and eat it that way. You can put it in salads. So we have that out here. Extra virgin olive oil is huge. Very important for the Mediterranean diet.
Extra virgin.
Right, extra virgin olive oil. It's great to cook with. If you're cooking chicken, for example, or steak, I like to sear my meat in the olive oil first, then put it in the oven to bake it. So that's a way to keep the moisture in. Garlic of clove. Clove is wonderful. Garlic is wonderful. You can take garlic and you can saute it. You can brown it. You can put it in all kinds of dishes. I tend to like it. It's good for your blood pressure, by the way. And lastly, the fifth thing I say you must have is lemons. Lemons are just wonderful. They're detox agents. They help activate enzymes in your liver that will help you cleanse your body even better. They taste great. They give a kick to your water. I don't like bland water, by the way. I like to have a little kick to it. And also, they're great with smoothies. So these are the things, I think, five things that you should have in your house.
Well, the crazy thing about this is doctors don't understand, frankly, where they come from and why are black women affected more than anybody else.
No, you know, and that's actually why we're fighting. You know, I'm wearing white, and I said, and teased that you're wearing white too.
I know, that's a total accident. There's no Pete and repeat thing happening here.
No, as I'm on the board of a nonprofit 501c3 called the White Dress Project, and we wear white to empower women. You know, to wear white because the truth is you can't wear white when you have fibroids because of the symptoms like heavy bleeding and just the weight gain, the bloating, and the truth is, you know, right now we're actually petitioning the White House to make July Fibroids Awareness Month nationally so that we can get to the bottom of making it a health agenda for corporations and medical institutions so that we can actually get legislation around it and help to fund research to get to the bottom of those issues because it's really treated like a headache. It's something that's a widespread epidemic. It affects over 80% of African American women by age 50. I personally had to suffer through 14 years battling with fibroids, 10 years of that infertility that was actually stemming from those fibroids. I had five fibroid surgeries, which ended in a hysterectomy this past March, five other complications, surgeries which were from complications from those fibroids, a miscarriage, five IVF cycles. This is not a story, this is real. 100 days in the hospital plus. My daughter actually fought the fibroids in my womb when I was finally pregnant after those 10 years. And my heart stopped on the operating table. But thank God, we have Little Miracle Nia, you know. But the truth is, that's not everybody's story.
Yep. Deborah details the steps she took to holistically changing her life in a new book, The Beginner's Guide to Healthy Living. What's happening?
How are you?
All good.
Thanks
for
having me.
All right, so here's the deal. So you and your husband, Pastor Freddie Haynes, out of Dallas, Friendship West Baptist Church, y'all trying to have a child, and nothing was working.
Right. Five physicians said that I would not get pregnant because I had stopped my cycle. And so I just knew that there was an answer, and I kept praying. I said, Lord, you're going to have to show me something. So he sent me to a holistic physician who helped me understand to change my mind and change my diet.
Now, who was that?
Jewel Pookrum.
Dr. Jewel Pookrum.
Yes.
So what is a holistic doctor?
She's an MD, but she practices medicine from the holistic, the whole person, not just one-sided. Sometimes Western medicine will look at just one aspect, but she looks at the whole person, and she said, you're nutritionally deficient.
Now, when she said that, you were like, what are you talking about? You probably thought you ate well and, you know, you were all good. What did that mean?
What that meant was my cells were not getting the nutrients that it needed so that my body would operate properly. And so she showed me my blood in the microscope. She said, oh, girl, you eat too much chicken. All this bacteria swimming around. I was like, oh, that is gross. But anyway, so she
And you were like, how she know I eat all this chicken?
Yeah, so anyway, she gave me a book list to read, which was profound because that book list is what gave me the information so that I can share with other people after I learned what I needed to learn.
So there was a blood test that you took, and so by examining your blood, because you know what they say at church.
It wasn't a test. It was in the microscope.
Right. But she still took your blood and examined it, because, you know, some of y'all who don't go to church is all in the blood. But we're going to leave that alone. But the thing is, so when she looked at it, so versus conventional doctors, she was looking at something totally different.
Yes.
Than what they were looking at.
Nutrition.
And she was looking at fluid levels. She was looking at all that sort of stuff.
What I was eating.
And as she was telling you this, what is going through your mind?
I'm open. I'm like, okay, I'm soaking it in because everyone else was saying they couldn't help me. And even one doctor said, well, you're going to get lupus. I said, how do you know what I'm going to get, you know, in the future? So when she gave me my prescription, which was to read the books, change my diet, do a cleansing, take some herbs, my body responded within 2 months. My cycle started again, and then within a year, I was pregnant.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
You are going to be fine. You want to have children? I am not a genie. I can only pray, okay? So we pray in time, but the reason why is actually you guys are too stressed. You have too many things on your plate from both sides. But in time, you're going to be fine, okay? And there's also a lady, Perona.
I felt
I didn't know how she know my relatives. I only met her today.
She details her many conversations with angels that have led to healing and growth for the living in her new book, Angel Whispers. Mahdi joins me with co-author Gail Hunt. Hey, how y'all doing?
Great.
Doing great. Thank you.
So, all right. So Mahdi, I guarantee there are people who are saying, give me a break. This is sort of nonsense. But the reality is, I've always understood this. My grandfather had the same spiritual gift. I know others who do the same thing as well. How do you explain to people what this spiritual gift actually is?
Okay, this is how it works. My gift as a mystic is your handshake, your embrace, your voice. Your voice especially is my frequency to tune in. So it's a one-way street. So that means that I can only hear your loved ones in heaven. I cannot ask questions. The people in front of me do. So therefore, I can tune in to those who are in heaven, and those who are in heaven do earthly work from heaven to help us here on earth do that heavenly work here on earth for ourselves and for others.
Gail, what did you find it interesting where you wanted to co-author this book?
We do have books in all over the world, but in Holland and Belgium and Europe, and we won an award there in 2008. But the truth of the matter is, it's so wonderful to be able to be on this journey to see people grow, how they listen to the angel whispers that Mahdi delivers, and how I see them personally grow. It's really very rewarding. It's wonderful. And of course, we travel together and we write together. And our goal really is to help people to help themselves and to get over that depression.
Have you ever said something to someone and they just completely freaked out and ran out of the room, and you sort of had to
in New York, actually.
We did this big presentation in Manhattan for a rap mogul, and a few ran out, but then they came back.
So wait a minute. So you were so on it, they ran out of the room.
Yes,
because afterwards they came back with the hands in the pocket, because before they were actually with arms folded sitting there, and then they said, no, I have nothing, and then they wanted to test and challenge me, so I did the right back at you.
Oh, so it was sort of like an MC challenge, and you said, let me show you what I'm working with.
You got it.
You got it.
All right.
So they came back and they said, I was spot on, you know, and like I said, it's not me. It's I can't take credit for what I say because I'm just listening in.
Somebody tell them I'm Destiny's child. Destiny brought me through. When the witches tried to hex me, when the haters tried to destroy me, when the enemy tried to devour me, when I tried to sabotage myself, destiny kept pulling me out of my trouble. I have a purpose to fulfill. And I tell you something right now, no weapon formed against me shall prosper.
There's a destiny call on all of our lives. When I look at people like yourselves who find that destiny call behind a desk like this, I found my destiny call behind the sacred desk of the pulpit, but that did not exclude the possibilities of finding my destiny in other areas. And I think when people define you by how they met you, mm-hmm. they limit you to how they see you. Then they incarcerate you in that limitation and penalize you for breaking out of their prison. I wrote the book Destiny because now more than ever we need people to break out of the prisons of what other people think and evolve into what their divine purpose is and walk in their destiny, and to also understand that destiny has steps. It is not
right.
It's not an elevator. You don't push a button and just pop out where you're going to be.
Or what I would tell folks is also doors. I mean, I have young people who come up to me and they say, I want to do what you do, and I go, well, stop. Have you looked at what I did?
Right.
To actually get here, man. And look, you know, I've used this example for you as well. You talked about starting with seven, mm-hmm. and I would say, you can't look at what Bishop Jakes here. You can't ignore when he was pastoring West Virginia.
Absolutely.
When he was digging ditches.
Absolutely.
So there's one young lady, she said, how'd I get there? I said, baby, first you got to walk through one door.
Yes.
I said, I guess that scene out of the Matrix, when you walk through one door,
yes.
and there's another door.
Absolutely.
I said, that's actually how it starts. I said, but you got to pick one door.
And respect to my book, I talk about respect the step you're on. So many times sometimes people are so busy trying to get to the top landing that they don't maximize where they are. The way you graduate is maximizing where you are. And until you respect where you are and throw your full self at it, in the book I talk about focus and putting your full self. Most of us have never thrown our full self at anything. We have throw ourselves at it, and then we want a whole harvest back from a half level of commitment. So I talk about, how do you focus? How do you appreciate where you are? And because the landing is advertised to us, we ignore the step. But until you appreciate the step, you can't make it to the landing. That appreciation and that graduation process is imperative. And it begins when you develop a sense of destiny, a sense of steps, and a sense of staging.
You say this in the book, quote, as we follow the instinctive path of our passion molded into action, we connect to destiny. As we explore the path to destiny, we gain a barometer by which we may measure authentic purpose, otherwise known as success.
Purpose is not so much dealing with the what as it is the why. I think so many times we are very clear about what we want.
Right.
But until we are clear about why we want it, then we don't really have purpose. You mentioned when you were talking a moment ago about this whole notion of wealth and fame. And to me, both of them are facilitators of purpose. If money has no purpose in and of itself, it can be used for good or evil. It depends on whose hands it's in. So if money is the destination, then you've lost everything. It's really the transportation through which you can accomplish a greater purpose. And you can't really get the money until you have a purpose that justifies it. You can't just get it just for egotistical reasons and really appreciate what I'm talking about in the book. You may have money, but you don't have true wealth.
Folks, look, we certainly appreciate you joining us for the 2015 Black Book Fest right here on News One Now on TV.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.